Well, Maine, I say A-M, A-N, Maine. All right, let's go here. 3, 2, 1. I'm Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Here at WGNplus.com, every Monday, a new episode posted at WGN Plus. And, of course, don't forget that while this may be episode 46, there are 45 previous episodes on something called Kevin, my landing page.
You have a landing page?
I have a landing page.
Who's landing there?
Well, I don't know. Hopefully more than two people. This is my producer who doesn't even know I have a landing page. Very nice. Yeah, I mean, if you go on WGN Plus and you go on the entertainment section.
Yeah.
And you hit that, and then there are a list of shows, and it says Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. You should try it sometime, Kevin.
They're calling it a landing page, huh?
They call it a landing page.
That sounds very official.
Yeah, it does. That's what they told me it was. I don't know. To me, it's a spot where all the webcasts are, or the podcasts are, right? Yeah. So if you've missed any in the past 45 episodes, you can always go back. And it does actually do you some good to go back, because frequently I will refer back to previous podcasts when need be in terms of different topics I may have talked about that I want to revisit, or perhaps different things have happened on a previous podcast where there is new news, and so it to feel a part of the whole Elton Jim experience here on the podcast, it's something that you might want to do, and they're all headlined, so you know you can just pick and choose and see if something catches your fancy, or if you are listening to a new one and you hear me refer back to a topic that I say that I've spoken about, then you can go back on the landing page and see what I initially said. So this way you'll know that I'm not BSing you when I'm saying how right I am once again. And that's going to happen today. So that's why I brought that up. My landing page. I feel like Neil Armstrong. Do you know Neil Armstrong is?
The astronaut, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very good. Now, yeah. The funny thing is, if you were older... Kevin's in his 30s. There was a time that the Bears had a head coach named Neil Armstrong.
Okay.
And he was a horrible coach.
Surprise.
As most coaches of the Bears were. He was in the mid-70s. Terrible coach. But his name was Neil Armstrong, and it was just funny because, I mean, everybody knew Neil, you know, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and this guy, you know, was far from any kind of a moonwalker in terms of making his stamp. He's lucky to be a footnote in the Bears' history. Although he came with a pedigree. He was from, I think, the Minnesota Vikings organization at the time. Minnesota was always the best team in the Bears' division. And they were also in a couple of, Super Bowls, and Fran Tarkenton and Bud Grant. I mean, they were huge. So this was like, wow, they've got one of, you know. They've got somebody from the Vikings.
Yeah.
They got the worst coach from the Vikings. That's who they got. But I digress, as I usually do. But I am going to mention something today that I have spoken about in the past several months ago, probably in 2016. So when you go to the landing page, you may need to go back into whenever football season started. That's a hint, is what I might be talking about today. But I'm very happy today on the show. Usually I talk about a couple of subjects, and I have either Emily Armonetti talking about pop culture, or for you longtime listeners, the first official Golden Ticket member of the Pop Culture Club was a friend of mine, as well as a radio producing veteran, Mick Kaler here in Chicago, who also you can hear his work on parody songs. He writes some parody songs that appear regularly on WGN television. And but my good friend Mick we go way back to college radio.
That's right.
30 years ago in Elmhurst. Good old WRSC 88.7 FM.
Long time ago.
How many watts was that radio station?
At the time that when I was there, and I think when you were there too, it was just 10 watts.
Yeah, 10 watts. I mean, you're lucky if it got to, like, the dorms across the mall.
Or in cold weather, sometimes it would go across from Elmhurst to Villa Park in Lombard.
Well, I must say, though, you know, for a small wattage station, we used to get a pretty good sampling.
Oh, sure.
Of people that listened and call in, and for the most part, they were requesting music. It was a music station, but Mick and I also kind of did what we do now. And as well as play music, we also did little segments and bits and stuff like that. And we met, you know, as just a weird happenstance. Mick was a couple years older than me, and I just started my show every Sunday, 6 to 9. And I had played. I'm a big fan of the TV show The Honeymooners. And there was a record that I found in one of the funnier episodes. There was this song that was played in the episode called The Hucklebuck, which was a big hit in the 40s and 50s. And so I played it on the show as kind of a funny gag. And Mick, I had seen Mick at the station, but never really even talked to him. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, and he said, and all he didn't even say hello or anything. He didn't even, I don't even think you introduced yourself. I think you just said, "Is that the song from The Honeymooners?"
That's right.
And I knew that I had a kindred spirit, and I've always often said that Mick and I were twin sons from different mothers.
Sons from different moms.
Yeah, yep. Because we had so much in common. He's a big Elton John fan and big music fan, sports fan, you name it. And so Mick and I...
Springsteen fan. And
yeah.
Even
Who
at
fan?
That time, we had the same type of VCR...
Yeah.
Beta.
Right.
Same brand.
Yeah. The Zenith Beta.
Yeah.
Man, I still have those bad Beta tapes. Of course, Kevin, the producer, who's 31, he's looking at me like, what's a Beta tape?
Yeah, what's a video cassette?
What's a video? Yeah. Yeah, forget about Beta. What's a VCR?
I remember those.
Is that some kind of porno thing?
What's going on here? I swear to God. I mean, half of the stuff that we grew up with is now in the Field Museum.
Yeah.
Next
exactly.
to Sue. Jeez. But so Mick and I have known each other for a long time, and as I've said many times on the show, Mick went on to be the producer for some very prominent radio shows in here in Chicago. Radio legend Larry Lujack and Robert Murphy, one of the more popular shows in the 80s, and then was one of the first to actually see that the country music format was going to be a big deal here in Chicago, and worked for several years at US 99 on many of their top rated morning shows. Who did you work with BJ Spangler?
JD Spangler and John Katzbach, rest his soul. And then after that, it was JD and Ramblin' Ray.
Yeah, Ramblin' Ray now is on WLS.
Right. And then after JD left, it was Ramblin' Ray and Trish. And then right before I left, it was Big John Howell, who I worked with at WCKG. John was moved from afternoons to mornings, and it was he and Ray with Trish and myself.
And now they're on Chicago radio, too.
Yeah, yeah. Still around.
So yeah, Mick definitely does a very impressive pedigree. And as I said, Mick was – so we did radio together at our radio station in Elmhurst. And then through that, we became somewhat of Western suburb sensations. Right?
And not on the radio either.
Yeah. Explain what that was.
Well, we one day, this was I think in the fall or the late summer of 83, and my old high school, York High School in Elmhurst, which is just around the corner from Elmhurst College, they needed DJs for a dance they were doing called MORP, which was prom.
Oh, that's right, the MORP. I forgot about the MORP.
And so they said, "Could you guys do that?" And I said, "Yeah, and I'll bring Jim Toronto, and we'll come over." And they said, "Well, how much do you charge?" And I said, "Well, we have to rent some PA equipment from the school here, and it'll cost $10, the turntables and the mixer and the speakers, and we brought a couple other speakers in." And they said, "Okay, that'll be fine." So yeah. We showed up. We set up.
Is that all we got paid? Was $10?
It was $10, our first pay. And then remember, Jim, it was in a big hall, And I think they packed the place with over 500 kids at like $3 a pop.
Yeah, and they gave us $10.
And so we played 3 hours and turned the night into a huge success. Everybody went nuts. They loved the show. And at the end of the night, the student council sponsor, the faculty sponsor, who was the one who was supposed to pay us, he's got enough money to choke.
Oh yeah, he pulled out. Yeah,
hand.
I forgot. He pulled out this wad of cash, like
right.
like some guy, like some pit boss in Vegas.
Right. Yeah. Just he says, "How much are you guys?"
Oh.
And Jim and I just look at each other and go, "That'll be $10, please."
And he gave us $10. Can you believe that?
Well, the good part of that was funny. I remember it was a Friday night, and the very next day, the York Student Council had a meet with a bunch of other student councils at other schools, and of course they told them, hey, this Mick and Jim guy, they played this great dance, and we got this great deal, and all of a sudden...
Yeah, this great deal.
Yeah, we didn't get that deal again. We learned our lesson.
Yeah.
And after that, we started playing like high schools, junior highs, all over the
world. Yeah, it was a very nice little side business, cash money.
Yeah.
And so we were DJs before David Guetta. Who are these guys?
David Guetta.
And Skrillex. What's
that
guy's name?
Skrillex.
And all this BS. These guys are making like $1 million a night now in Vegas. And you and I... We're sitting there 30 years ago, and we thought this was just like a lark.
Oh yeah.
And the thing that was fun about these shows was, you know, now don't forget, we had two turntables. We had to bring peach crates full of albums. There was no such thing as even CDs at this time.
Yeah, we had very few of that. Yeah, exactly.
But we just didn't sit back with our with our PF Flyers untied and our hats to the side. with our black jackets and going zizzle, zizzle, zizzle. We actually went out there and put on a show. I mean, it was all very organic. I mean, to be honest with you, when we said to that guy initially that we'll take $10, I mean, he was, from what we had planned,
right?
We were ripping him off.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what we wound up performing and doing, it happened all on the fly. You know, all of a sudden, we were sitting there on this stage, this kind of riser, and suddenly we looked at one another and said, okay, what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to play? And how are we going to do this? Because now there's a dance here.
Right.
And yet, we what was great about that, too, is that we were very close in age at that time to the seniors.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're only a couple of years out of high school. So we knew the music very well that they would like, and we also knew music well enough to know what people were going to dance to. But we didn't just sit in the back and act cool. We went out and danced on the stage. It was goofy.
We pulled kids up on stage.
We pulled people up, and so it was actually like we were lip syncing. We were so far ahead of our time in what we did. At the time it looked silly, but now there are TV shows based on what we were doing.
Exactly, we were way ahead as far as that goes.
Yeah, we were just lip syncing, and we were getting people to dance, and as time went on, I mean, I always had fun. I mean, I would dress up like Cyndi Lauper because she was popular, and I would do the whole girls just want to have fun dance, or when Jump came out, I'd get up on top of the speakers and do the David Lee Roth split thing, and
plus we introduced the songs, and we'd even play the oldies.
Yeah,
we played all pumped up.
Yeah, we used to play. We were playing Shout.
The bottom line is what I always told people who had never been to the dances we did. I said we were two DJs that turned every event into like a Springsteen concert.
Yeah.
Where at the end of the night, everybody was soaked in sweat.
Definitely.
Laughing and smiling and had a great time. And
yeah.
I'm not bragging. It's just that's what we did.
I wish we would have had a video. I mean, unfortunately back then, you know, no one had videos. Nobody had cell phones.
Right.
Take a picture of this. But I would love to have seen what that looked like. In fact, I still have. One year, Michael Jackson made a commercial for Pepsi. And the stuff he used in his hair ignited.
Yeah,
and his hair
with some stage explosion.
Yeah,
right.
And so his hair burned, and for a while they showed the video. His hair went up in smoke, and there was a flame, like a tall flame, and you could see it on YouTube. Just hit, Michael Jackson Pepsi commercial, and there's this big tall flame for a while, he doesn't even realize it because his hair is burning. And then when the flame actually burned through his hair and hit his scalp, then he and everybody sees it. It was so quick, and it is on YouTube. And so when we did the next event that we did after that, because, I mean, this was huge news.
Yeah, it was all over the
because Michael Jackson was the biggest star of the world at that point. And when this happened, we found these two jackets that, because Michael Jackson used to wear these military jackets. So we found these two kind of military-looking jackets, and then we took cardboard, and, like, if you've ever seen, like, you know, the old arrow through the head thing where you stick it on top of your head, and it's got, like, some kind of a hanger.
Like a shot, yeah.
You know, like, it goes around your head to keep it in place. Well, I in fact, now my wife, at the time she was my girlfriend, she made these flames, these tall flames, used a hanger for the put on our head, and so when we came out to start this dance, we played Billie Jean, and we had these jackets and these big giant flames on our heads, and we came out to bump 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 bump, and the kids were looking at us like, "What the heck?"
It was our Michael Jackson tribute. What's the big deal?
And the funny thing is, I still have the flames, Mick.
That's sad.
I still have the. So if we ever want to do that again and have like
we
some
anniversary,
yeah, we don't have some anniversary show.
Sure.
I still have the flames.
Well, that's good to know. Those are props that belong in the broadcast museum, maybe. Okay.
But I'll tell you, it was a great time. We had a great time. The kids had a great. We did a marathon dance one time, and
yeah, overnight dance.
Overnight, yeah. We were there for like 12, 15 hours.
Yeah,
and. You know,
the other thing that I always tell people, because, you know, we obviously got paid for these things, and I and we had an assistant. Our friend Alan was our guy that helped lug all the equipment in with us and everything.
Yeah, he was a high school kid who listened to us on the radio, and then he wound up helping us at these dances.
Yeah, and I told people, I said, when I'd come back from one of these things, I'd say, I got paid, you know, after expense and everything, I got paid $120 to be the life of a party, you know, with my friend.
What I can't believe in retrospect now, as I look back at my youth, we were so goofy and stupid for like 3 hours, like you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, we were on we were on stage performing. Now, granted, they were high school. Most of them were high school kids, so maybe that's why. But you know, just between us girls here, I mean, it never. Nothing ever afterward.
Nothing untoward happened.
Yeah, you know what I'm trying to get at here?
Right.
I mean, we just like cleaned up the, we tore down the stage. We took the big speakers back. We loaded up the albums and we drove away.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever, I don't think we ever really, now we could have gotten arrested.
Sure.
You know, depending on what the age of consent is. But we never really, I don't think we ever really took advantage. I mean, one time, remember this? Oh, gosh, this was really funny. We did a Christmas party.
Oh, yeah.
We did a Christmas party in an office.
That's right.
Now, that's the one that there should have been some extracurriculars after that one.
Yeah, we brought in just my stereo.
Yeah.
There were like, 50, 75 people.
Yeah.
And
it was very
cranked up the tunes, and there were secretaries.
Yeah,
secretaries,
I see.
Ladies.
Yeah, what was our, I don't know what we were thinking or not thinking.
Right.
I mean, we were the hired help, but I mean, yeah, you know, still. I mean, because then it got weird. If you remember, it was like this Christmas party, it was in this office. And we were in this middle section of the office that must have been like the little bullpen area. And there were offices and cubes. And so we set up just a regular stereo because you couldn't play a whole big thing. We'd blow them out of there. But we were playing the music and we're just kind of, bopping around and walking around and mingling. And then there came a point where they turned the lights off. Remember that?
Yeah.
They turned the lights off. And so it was like you're in a 16-year-old dance. Or
right.
like a party at when you're 16 years old and you go to somebody's basement.
Little dark corner where you go with somebody,
And so in retrospect now, I'm thinking back, I'm going, what was going on when they turned those, because people were slow dancing.
Oh, sure.
And it was a Christmas party.
Yeah.
So this was like Bad Santa or something.
Well, you know, it's the old joke of the rock star who doesn't get the women. The roadies get the women.
Yeah,
you know, security people. We were the roadies, so we were so busy hauling stuff out, we didn't have time to cruise for women.
Yeah, I mean, my gosh, if I only had those years back now. Oh, but anyway, so when I started to do some fill-in here at WGN Radio and then started the podcast, I definitely wanted to hook up again with Mick and do some radio, and so we started to do that, and Mick appears quite often when I do fill-in, and when I started the podcast, he was my first, pop culture club member. As I said, you have the official, your card says 0001 on it.
That's it.
And so thankfully, Mick had some free time. He his schedule changed because he had been doing the Pop Culture Club with me for the first couple 3 months of this podcast back in 2016. And then his schedule changed, so that's when Emily came aboard, and some other people have joined in as well. But we had a chance to, Mick said, hey, I've got some free time, and so if you want to do something. So I said, certainly. So what I wanted to do is talk about a couple of different subjects, and they're not just going to be pop culture stuff. Like I said, Mick and I, we have a lot of the same interests in a lot of different areas, and so I wanted to touch base on a couple of things. As luck would, not luck, but as circumstances would be, I filled in on WGN a couple of weeks ago on the day after Chuck Berry died.
Right.
And I did have Mick already scheduled as a guest to talk about some pop culture topics. And so obviously the Chuck Berry topic dominated what we talked about. And in that conversation, not only were we talking about the impact of Chuck Berry, but if you were reading a lot of the obituaries on Chuck Berry and about his history, Chicago played a huge role. Even though he was from St. Louis, it was in Chicago and at the legendary Chess Records on the South Side where Chuck was discovered and recorded all of his major, groundbreaking, impactful, influential hits.
Right. And real quickly, to show how quickly things change, Chuck Berry was obviously a musician. He got in trouble. He got spent some time in prison for the Mann Act, which is taking an underage girl across state lines for improper.
See, now that's the difference. Like when you and I played high schools, we didn't touch anybody.
Exactly.
But obviously,
we never had our arrest record is clean.
Yeah, we had no offenses for the Mann Act.
Exactly. Nothing like that. Not even going across the county or the gym floor. Right.
Unlike Chuck Berry, obviously.
So he'd spent some time in prison, and then he wanted to go up to Chess Records and meet up there. So he gets out of prison. A buddy drives him up to Chicago, and he starts picking out his songs and playing them. He was asked to play four songs. He had six. He starts rocking them out, and they're like, well, we got to sign this guy. And poor Chuck, he didn't even have, like, decent clothes, you know, like a musician should have. They had to bring him to some stores in Chicago just to get him, you know, decked out to be the, you know, up-and-coming rock star that he became.
Well, here's the thing. So a side angle of the story, then, was what I was saying was because in all of these obituaries, Chess Records played a major role in Chuck Berry's career. And I have always maintained and that for many, many, many years that while Chicago always claims to be the home of the blues, it is. However, from a cultural standpoint in this city, from a tourist standpoint in this city, there is, aside from having a blues fest, which every major city has, Chicago has done a woeful job, a horrible job, of promoting and stepping up as the blues capital of the world in terms of attracting tourists and really solidifying. All we say is, oh, we're the home of the blues. Oh, Chicago Blues. And there's the Kingston Mines. And aside from that, you know, and the Buddy Guy's legends. And, you know, aside from that, you know, Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon and all these guys that defined Chicago blues were here in Chicago, and we have paid lip service. We talk about it when they give speeches about Chicago, but in terms of anybody coming here, if you were a Blues fan, where do you go?
Right. Like you just mentioned, Kingston Mines or Buddy Guy's Legends or the Blues Club. It's like, okay, that's where like a hardcore person would go, but there is no, as you said, tourist situation that says, hey, here's some history of what's going on and what happened years ago.
You go to Memphis, you go to Beale Street.
Yeah, and you got all of it going on.
Yeah,
there.
It's a two block rate. It's a two block thing, but every place has some joint where there's some music being played. You go to New Orleans for jazz, and you walk down the French Quarter, and everywhere you go, there's music played. You know, you come to Chicago, Kingston Mines and Buddy Guy's Legends aren't even in the same zip code.
Right.
And Chess Records does exist, I understand, as a museum. However, it is not publicized. It does not get busloads of people. And all I know is when I went to Memphis, one of my stops was Sun Records.
Exactly.
Where Elvis was discovered, as well as Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and Roy Orbison by Sam Phillips. I mean, this is a place where rock and roll, you know, certainly took off. But we have Chess Records. Every obituary talked about how Chuck Berry invented rock and roll.
Yeah, he was the godfather of rock and roll.
And those songs that invented rock and roll were recorded at Chess Studios here in Chicago.
And to take it on a sidestep, we talked before about the Rolling Stones. They came to America. First thing they said is, we got to get the Chess Records.
They didn't go to, when the Rolling Stones came to the United States, they did not go first to the Statue of Liberty. They did not go see the White House.
No.
They did not go see Mount Rushmore. They came
they
to Chicago.
Go to Navy Pier, okay?
They came to Chicago and they recorded in Chess Studios, and they even named an album after it, the address.
Right. One of the first songs they recorded was old Chuck Berry song, Carol.
Yeah. So I've said on many occasions that, you know, that Chicago really just has paid lip service. And all that the mayor, Emanuel, talks about is how he wants to, you know, increase, tourism. And I want this X amount of, you know, 50 million tourists a year, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, whenever there's a, some kind of a video or a compilation about Chicago, oh, the home of the blues and all that. Well, prove it.
Yeah, they just say it. And, you know, part of that, too, is the tourism. As far as the masses, like you're talking about, and Chicago's done a poor job of promoting it, they're busy with Millennium Park and the Bean, well, and Navy Pier and the Lakefront and the Cubs and Lollapalooza, those kinds of things. And again, something as important as, like you said, the base of the blues and Chicago blues and the birth of rock and roll. It's like a side story that nobody wants to get to.
Well, it's a hugely untapped resource, and what, like I said, what bugs me is, don't, you know, if you're gonna walk the walk, then talk the talk. Do it. Don't say you're the home of the blues, and then if somebody's a big blues fan or a big music fan and comes here, like I said, hey, you know, I've gone to cities because of my musical interest,
right?
And they have this centralized area where there's where the music is. And you go to Chicago, and they talk about the blues, and even Chicago has had a huge impact in jazz, in the early days of jazz.
Yeah.
You know, if you know the song that Frank Sinatra sings, in the original lyric, it goes, you know, my kind of town Chicago is, you know, and it has all that jazz. It's in the song.
Yep.
It was known for jazz. I dare you to go through anywhere in downtown Chicago or anywhere and find me a string of jazz clubs or anywhere. Is there a plaque somewhere?
No.
That says, here's where Benny Goodman played, or they all played here. Tommy Dorsey, all these guys. And yet, once again, Chicago told, oh, we were great jazz. Where? You know, don't just put it on a license plate. You know, have some places where people can actually go and experience it and use it as a drawing card. I mean, I just saw this article in the paper recently, Chuck Berry or Keith Richards, who was hugely influenced by Chuck Berry.
Right.
In the article, Right off, here's this guy. Here's the question. Was it Chuck Berry who first made you aware of chess? He says, at my age and my development at the time, I wanted to know where the records were made. And to me, it was all important. My awareness of chess records was from Chuck Berry. And when I listened to Muddy Waters, I realized that those guys were working in the same room. And that's where I wanted to be.
And that was a big deal to them.
Yeah. Then they said, you know, that they their first trip to the U.S. was in 1964, and you made sure that a visit to chess and to record there was on your thing. We were amazed that that all came together. At the time, it felt like, wow, we've just passed on and gone to heaven. The Rolling Stones thought going to Chess Records was like going to heaven. And I guarantee you, and myself included, so I blame myself, if Chicago has 2.8 million people, 2.8 million people in Chicago have never been to Chess Records.
That's right.
You know, which is, so here's my point as I ramble around here. I just talked about this, you know, a couple of weeks ago on the radio about how Chicago needs to really embrace its blues heritage, and it's really dropped the ball. And I was really happy to see in the paper this week that there are plans for a legitimate Chicago Blues Experience Museum, a 50,000-square-foot museum that will be in the Loop just near Millennium Park, which will play to tourism. It's going to be run by some of the former people that have curated and run the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and some other well-known music museums. And so it finally looks like somebody's waking up.
And right. I guess and realizing what like you said, an untapped resource we have. One of the things when I read the article said that I was glad about was they first wanted to put it at Navy Pier.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, don't do that because there's too many things going on there. Make this, and it's only a couple blocks away from Millennium Park, just
yeah.
west of it. As you said, 25 East Washington Street. It's like, look, you're right down here. Come experience this. Put yourself away from the circus of Navy Pier or the fun at Millennium Park. Come a couple blocks away and see something really cool.
Yeah, and I mean, they're going to have artifacts. They're going to have, you know, obviously interactive kind of different things. And wisely, they're also going to have a small 150-seat lounge where there will be blues music being played every day. So at least, you know, if somebody says, "Hey, I'm a big blues fan. I got to go to Chicago to see the Blues Museum."
Yeah, there's a big attraction now.
And if they're smart, they will have buses that will take people to Chess Records.
Sure.
Whereas I said, you had people like Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon and all these blues people. And I'll tell you, you know, I don't even blame. You know, I do blame you know the city fathers for this over the years, but I have to say. And I don't think I'm out of line by saying this. Sadly, I think one of the reasons why Chicago has never really embraced its blues heritage is because, sadly, this is one of the most segregated cities in the country.
Oh, right, exactly. There were certain people of certain socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds that were like, okay, you're going to live here, and these people are going to live there, and it's going to be separate.
And I think,
there was no integration.
Yeah, I think that there was there was this great influx of African Americans from the South, you know, that came up to Chicago for jobs because Chicago was a growing metropolis in the early part of the 1900s and, you know, into the 30s and 40s. And so all these people were coming up for jobs, but they were musicians.
Yeah.
And they brought their guitars with them. And they were former, and many times if they weren't slaves themselves, they were, you know, related, their grandparents were slaves. And so that blues tradition and that gospel tradition came from the South to Chicago, and it was there on the South Side where it was born, and you had these guys like Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon and so many others that were playing the music. But I think that this city and its city leaders were so prejudiced and the city was so segregated that was going on there, and that didn't seep into mainstream culture.
Right.
And so I don't think Chicago embraced it because, sadly, it was a black thing.
If you're black, you're into that, and you'll go to some smoky club somewhere and hang out.
And so we, I think, sadly, our segregated history in this city has played a part, and hopefully now, as times are changing, and there's less. I mean, look, there's always going to be racial problems in this country. It's part of our history. But at least there is a little more of an openness and a striving for diversity. And so something like this Blues Museum, it may be way, way overdue, but I think it's a great sign not only for the tourism, but it might be a good sign at least that Chicago is maybe breaking some of these old mindsets. And here's the thing that was also to your point. You were saying how you were glad that they were putting it downtown, you know, near Millennium and stuff like that. Some people have argued, well, it should be on the south side or the west side because that's where, you know, that's where the Blues and that's where the African American neighborhoods and things like that. And to their they said no, we want to have the most. We want this to be where there's going to be more access.
Exactly. You want to be, as the article said, centrally located, so it's accessible to the people who are tourists.
And I'm not saying anything against these neighborhoods, but as we all know, Chicago has a very, very serious crime problem in those exact areas.
Exactly. And if you want to say, oh, we got a new Blues Museum and it's on the south side at so-and-so spot, people are going to go, I'm not going there. I'm not going to go get shot.
Exactly. I mean, until we can solve that problem, I mean, they're looking to raise $30 to $40 million for this. If I'm someone that's going to be investing money, because this is not a city project. This is a privately funded museum, and so look, these people. I understand that you want the roots, and they acknowledge. Look, we know the west sides and the south sides are the root lands of where blues happened here in Chicago. But in terms of tourism and in terms of access, it does make more sense to have it downtown, in the loop, close to where people are going, especially Millennium Park is, you know, one of the main draws here. So I'm glad that they are using that kind of mindset, because while it might be good in theory, people might be afraid to go there.
Right.
And then what are you doing? I mean, have you ever been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland?
Yeah, I've been there twice.
Yeah, me too. Now, a lot of people might even forget. But the way that, if you remember, the way that Cleveland got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame back in 1986, you know, once again, don't forget, there's no such thing as the internet. There's no online voting. There's no nothing. There was 800 phone numbers. Remember that?
Yeah, you could call in, right.
They had like five cities. There was Cleveland, Chicago, New York, L.A., and I think, Memphis were the five cities that came down to the finals. So Chicago was in it because of its history with Chess Records.
Yeah.
At that time in the 80s, Cleveland was like the armpit of the United States.
And it needed a major resurgence.
Yeah, the city had been decimated, and it was not in good shape economically and culturally. There was a famous one of its rivers actually was so polluted it started on fire.
The Cuyahoga River.
The Cuyahoga River literally started on fire because there was so much crap in the river that it started on fire. So this was a chance. And so what Cleveland did as a city, they banded together radio stations, TV stations, and they got everybody to call that 800 number because whoever got the most votes got the museum.
And they got it.
And every other city, like Chicago or New York or L.A., was kind of like, but Cleveland made this a municipal, project. And so they won it going away. Now, sadly, it's really not a good location.
No, it's off by the lake, and it's right by the football stadium.
Well, it's not even that. It's just that Cleveland, I mean, the reason why Cleveland was in the list is because there is a disc jockey named Alan Freed. And Alan Freed coined the term rock and roll, and he was like the first rock and roll disc jockey, and so that's where Cleveland had its connection to rock and roll. But as nice as a facility as it is, and it's on the lake, but who goes to Cleveland?
Yeah.
And so sadly, it's a great venue. There's some really cool stuff there. I've been there two or three times, and I've seen not only just the regular things, but then I've even seen some special exhibitions that were amazing. I mean, my gosh, they had one on John Lennon that I went to see. I mean, his bloody glasses.
I saw those too. I was at that too.
Holy smokes! And the paper bag that Yoko was given when he left, after he got killed, when he left the emergency with his bloody clothes were in this paper bag because they had to tear his clothes off to work on him, even though he was dead on arrival pretty much. But I mean, and then there was all other artifacts. But I mean, my gosh, you know, the bloody glasses, that was amazing. And then there was this amazing Springsteen exhibit a few years ago that I went to see. But here's my point. I literally, when I went there, I flew in.
Just to see this.
For the day.
Right.
I took a cab from the airport, and I had a flight 5 hours later.
Right. Well, it was a destination situation for you, whereas other people are going to come to Cleveland, and it may be the same for Chicago with the Blues experience. They're going to be like, hey, I'm in for the weekend to check out this and that. I'm going to go to a ball game and this and do these other things. Well, why don't you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Oh, yeah, I should check that out while I'm here. Hopefully that'll happen in Chicago. Hey, I'm here for a Cub game, and I got a convention. And you know what? I got some free time. Maybe I can go to the Blues experience.
Well, and that's my point, though, is that sadly, I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, if it was in New York or if it was in Chicago, would probably be much more visited. Just because they're bigger cities and bigger tourist attractions. Yes, it does fit in Cleveland to some extent because of Alan Freed. You know, so you can make an argument for that. But that is in terms of a tourist attraction, of drawing the most people. I don't know if Cleveland's the best place for it. So my point here is that at least when they are going to locate this Blues Museum, yes, it might belong on the south side. It might belong on the west side. But if you really want people to go, especially with the national headlines that Chicago is making over the last couple of years with our murder rate, you know, to put something on the south side of Chicago at this point to draw tourists, I don't think that's a great idea.
Yeah, they need to set themselves up for success.
Yeah.
That's why the location and the decision they've made is much better.
Yeah, so I have to say, this is not the doing of the city. This is a private project, but I am very glad to see that this is something that will possibly be an offering, so Chicago can actually, you know, lay some claim to being, you know, the home of the Blues. I mean, when you talk to anybody that is a Blues fan, the term they use is Chicago Blues. It's not
That's
just
the label. That's
it's not
exactly
just
the
Blues. It's Chicago Blues.
Yeah.
And so for this city to only being waking for to only waking, and this is maybe going to open in 2019. You know, in the middle of, you know, in the first, you know, quarter or so of the 21st century to have finally done something like this? I mean, why, gosh, talk about dropping the ball.
Well, it's about time they picked it up. So
yeah, so I'm very glad to hear that. Not sure if they listened to the show last Sunday or a couple of Sundays ago when I was talking about this and ranting, and now maybe they heard that show and they said, okay, let's put a Blues Museum together. That's what I'm going with. They heard me.
I think it was a little bit more thought into it, but again, you know, your concerns are very valid.
Yeah. So so now here's another one, and I said at the beginning of the show, you know, I have a landing page where all of these episodes are at. And about 6 months ago, now I think you and I were still talking about this. I think you and I were still doing the show. So remember, like, at the beginning of last football season, Colin Kaepernick?
Oh, yeah.
Decides to, make his big political statement.
His protest of sitting during the national anthem.
Yeah, taking a knee.
Doing it in protest of how the minorities were being hurt by the police.
Yeah, so, and his goal was that he would not stand until social injustice in America was gone.
Well, you're going to be sitting for a long time if you're waiting for that.
Well, that's what I said. I said, okay, as I said before, even here, social injustice in this country is in our DNA. All of our founding fathers were slave owners. Okay?
Yeah.
So that kind of huge statement, I said at the time, you know, this was not a very well thought out protest. I am all for anybody saying whatever they want to say. You have this is America, you have the right to say it. Don't have to agree with it, but you have the right to say it. But I was just saying, if you are really serious, Colin Kaepernick, about this issue, taking a knee during the national anthem is not the correct way to do it. The message and the messenger have to match for something to be effective. And first of all, Colin Kaepernick was protesting about how minorities were being, with all the police shootings and the social injustice. Do you know Colin Kaepernick's story, Mick?
He was adopted, I believe, right?
He was a black guy who came from a horrible family.
Yeah, he got taken in by another family.
By a white family.
Right.
And ultimately was raised and became a millionaire quarterback.
There you go.
Is that the guy who's supposed to be saying how bad the system is? Because he is an example of the system working.
Right. Yeah, he was a success story.
Yeah. So he's not the messenger. And then his gesture, his activism, you know, if you want something done, you say, okay, look, I'm going to go on a hunger strike until, you know, Tom Smith is let out of jail. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. So the goal here is Tom Smith being let out of jail. That's something tangible. Can you define for me the end of social injustice in America?
Right. Yeah. There's no measure for that.
Yeah.
And, the other part of it is, especially because people are so patriotic, that the anthem was the wrong angle to go for. And I kept wondering, you know, I know he was putting some money together to get some support some people for some of the injustices they were facing and things. And it's like, why don't you hold seminars or try to organize some national movement where it's not just you being, you know, shown every week's standing for the national anthem, and grow this out quickly with your fame and your popularity. And instead it all zeroed in on him. So it wasn't just that he was like a wrong example, a person for this. He was just going about it in such, you know, messed up ways.
Well, not even that, but here's the thing. When you use the American flag as your flashpoint for your protest, the American flag is has multi meanings.
Yeah.
So if you're not standing, if you're going to take a knee and not stand for the American flag, that means you're also not going to stand and not to appreciate the American veterans who fight for that flag.
And the ones that are currently doing it, exactly.
Right.
And that's another thing that got so many people upset.
Yeah, so or you're showing that you're unpatriotic, that you're a traitor, that you hate the country. So, you know, it was so misguided. It was so ill-informed. Clearly, you know, I mean, somebody started whispering in his ear. And he obviously got somebody talking about, you know, oh, you can do all this. But he got really bad advice, and clearly either his family or his management was not able to either talk him down from this or try to, you know, explain what was so, but this was so bad. And the reason I'm talking was just a wrong thing in terms of how to do it. I have no problems with what he was saying, but his gesture was just wrong.
Yeah, his methods, yeah.
And so here's the best part. So now he's a free agent. No team wants to touch him.
And apparently he has already made a reverse on his...
Yeah, of course, which I predicted. I said, you're going to be sitting for the rest of your life. And not only that, but no one's going to notice, because after 6 months, nothing's going to change. We've
right.
been waiting
and,
500
and,
years
and like
for this
said,
to change.
That was the method that was so messed
yeah.
up. But now nobody wants to come near him. Because it's like, what do you mean? That guy wouldn't stand for the American flag and the national anthem, blah, blah, blah. And now he wants a job. Why would you give him that job?
And so now, if you notice, I don't know if you're watching, over the last several weeks, because, you know, it's getting time that, you know, people are starting to look, you know, with the draft is coming up and stuff like that. he's now donating money to Meals on Wheels.
Yeah, and he also did a big thing for some poor people in like Africa. Or
yeah,
some,
so now I'm sure now his agent said, you know what, Colin? Nobody's calling.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to do some major, major damage control here.
Yeah, we got to turn back the tide here.
You know, and it's just like when he did this so many months ago, I was like, boy, this guy made such a mistake in how he went about this. And this can do nothing but fail. And what's interesting now is that it's coming home to roost because his gesture, his method didn't do anything. Nothing changed at all. And now he's had to step back. Now he's going to stand for the national anthem because now he's like, wait a minute. I want my $1 million to be a quarterback.
Yeah. I want to play football again.
Yeah. And so, once again, folks, it's not, you know, I'm all for activism and I'm all for speaking what you talked about. And as I said, but it, to me, if you're going to walk the walk, you got to talk the talk. You got to do it. But take a step back and really think about how you're going
to
do this.
Yeah, and you got to think of what your end result you want it to be. And again, like I said, you've got to think this through, like you said, and say, okay, is this really the right way to do this? I mean, his heart's in the right place as far as his concern goes, and I can back that up 100%. But the methods to do it were so flawed that it's like you're setting yourself up for failure.
Do you remember the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Right. Yeah, all the people that were camped out and doing the little cities and all that, right.
Another example. There was no game plan. Everybody was gathering and they were protesting. But when you talk to somebody and said, what do you want? You got a blank stare.
Right.
No one knew what they wanted. They just thought it was cool to go and camp out and protest. About what?
On the news.
But protest about what?
Yeah.
And what is your end game? If you're going to do a protest, you know, in the 1960s, the end game was get out of Vietnam. That was the end game.
Right.
So the protest made sense. And ultimately, they did lead to that. Nixon was looking out the window going, my God, those people are out there protesting. I better do something about this.
And I know what they want because they've stated it. They have a clear goal set up.
Yeah. You have to have a clear goal, and you have to do it in a way that's going to make an impact.
Well, you know, to put it in a pop culture sense, look at Seinfeld, all those years that Kramer protested the pay he wasn't getting at the bagel shop.
Bagel, bagel, bagel.
Yeah, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel. And he finally was like, you know, he went back to work as a bagel maker because they brought the minimum wage up. He had a goal. He said, I want the minimum wage to be a certain amount of money.
It took 12 years, but he finally...
Right. He could have been working somewhere else, but...
And very quickly, Nick and I are big hockey fans.
Oh, yeah.
And big Blackhawk fans. In fact, I was always very jealous of you, Mick, because Mick was born and raised in Elmhurst. And my idol... Tony Esposito from the Blackhawks, good old number 35, lived in Elmhurst.
Yeah, I used to see him around town all the time.
Yeah, and hung out. I mean, he used to hang out in, like, you know, the local watering holes. So you would see him quite a bit, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, see him and his wife and his kids. I knew where he lived because he lived down the street from a friend of mine.
Oh, did you? I didn't know you knew where he lived. Why didn't you tell me?
Oh, yeah.
I could have, like, you know, I could have rung the doorbell.
Well, no, I don't want this stalker thing going. You got enough going with the Elton John stuff. I didn't need you doing that with Tonio.
Hey, all I know is these days, me and Tonio, we're buddies now.
Yeah, but if he knew how scary that you could be with this. Hey, no, seriously, Tony lived right near a park in Elmhurst called East End Park, and I would see him jogging in the summertime, getting in shape for the new season. He'd have this big sweatshirt on and these plastic pants so he could sweat.
Really?
And his knees were all bandaged up, taped up, all the years of banging around on his knees on the ice.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would be jogging there in the summertime because we didn't really have health clubs back then.
No.
Treadmills and stuff.
Right.
So he would just train there, and we'd see him in the summertime doing that.
So here's my question to you. As a Blackhawk fan of many decades, and certainly in the last, you know, everybody now is a Blackhawk fan in the last 7 or 8 years.
And that's one thing real quickly. everyone who goes to the games and puts their pictures on Facebook, I always have to send back to them, hey, I was there when I was 5 years old.
Yeah, no kidding.
Long time.
Well, here's the thing that I was thinking about. You know, because I just went to a game a couple of weeks ago, great game, where they played the Minnesota Wild, and that was kind of the first game.
Oh, yeah, it was a good game.
Where
yeah.
they actually, they were a couple of points behind, and now they're like 7 or 8 points ahead in first place. The first two goals, the first two shots the Hawks took, they scored two goals. They pulled the goalie in the first 5 minutes of the game for the Wild. So it was a great game. But as I was watching, I mean, when you go to a game at the United Center, the Blackhawks organization has done an amazing job in marketing this team now.
Oh, yeah. It's not just the game on the ice. There's all the things in between. Not just in between the periods, but in between the face-offs.
I mean, there's something going on. The music is blaring. This is the first time I saw this. This is the first game I've been to. They used to shoot those T-shirts and those cannon guns.
Yeah.
Now they drop them with these little parachutes. It's a cool.
For the ceiling? For the
yeah.
Of the, okay.
They did that at the Oscars when they dropped the candy.
Yeah.
And have you seen that, Kevin?
I actually got one.
No, you caught one?
I caught one, yeah, for my wife. Yeah.
Honest to God.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at that. I got the
really? Well,
there.
You're a tall guy. You can get, you can grab. Oh, my gosh. So did you just follow it down?
Followed it, yeah. And then as it got close, I just did a little jump and grabbed
it. How funny.
Yeah.
Grab.
It's like an XL shirt.
Right, yeah. But it was like the coolest thing. I mean, there is always something going on there. And they have done an amazing job of marketing this team. I mean, I'll tell you. I mean, the last 20 years especially, I mean, hockey in this town wasn't even the fourth sport.
No. Exactly.
And the Blackhawks, you have to remember, the Chicago Wild, which is a Chicago Wolves, which is like a farm team, was filling up the Rosemont Horizon, or the Allstate Arena.
Yeah, in the 90s, they were selling out like crazy.
Because the Blackhawks... The tickets were way too expensive for what the terrible product on the ice was. That gave birth to the Chicago Wolves as an alternative for hockey fans to say, hey, guys, come here for $10 a game, and you can see hockey.
And you're going to have a great experience.
As
right.
opposed to going to the stadium at that time, or the New United Center, for $100 and seeing horrible hockey. And, I mean, I went to a couple of games. I'm not even exaggerating. There were 5,000 people in the United Center. I could hear people at the other end of the arena talking.
Oh, sure.
And one game I went to, this was in the mid-90s, when Detroit was very dominant. And, you know, at those days when they were winning all their Stanley Cups and everything, people in Detroit couldn't get tickets. But there was nobody was going to Blackhawks games, so Detroit fans... Whenever the season tickets, like when the tickets went on sale, Detroit fans sold out the United Center.
Yeah, just so they could go to get the game. Right.
So I walk into the United Center. Now, this is in the 90s. People have to remember, too, if you're a newish Blackhawk fan, the Blackhawks used to wear the white jerseys at home.
Exactly.
It's only the last 10 years or so where they wore the red at home. They always used to wear white for almost their entire, you know, the entire history of the team, I would say, for a great part at least. So they always wore white at home. I walk into the stadium, into the bowl of the arena. The whole stadium is red.
Yep.
With Detroit Red Wings jerseys.
Yeah, there you go.
So I sit down, and so now the Red Wings score. The roar of the crowd is unbelievable. I'm sitting there going, am I at a home game?
Well,
where am I?
That's the good news about how the Hawks are now, because now when the Hawks score goals in St. Louis or in Colorado, you hear this roar, and it's all the Chicago fans, but you experienced it the other way.
Yeah, I'm sitting here going, wow, this is not a Blackhawk game.
Yeah.
I'm at a home game. I'm at an away game in my own arena.
Right, yeah, I'm away and I'm home, yeah.
And I told Rocky Wirtz that one time. And, you know, when the team was beginning to, you know, to make its comeback, and he said the same thing. He said, I know exactly what you're talking about. He said, I was in the concourse one time. I heard this roar go up.
We scored.
I run into the bowl of the arena, and I see Detroit scored.
Yeah, they got their sticks up and all that.
So this, I mean, the Blackhawks franchise was at a very, very low point. And so John McDonough and Rocky Wirtz and Jay Blunk have done an amazing job of not only, you know, putting a quality team on the ice with Stan Bowman as the general manager, but they've done an amazing job of marketing the team as a as an entity. But here's my question to you, as a longtime hockey fan, because, you know, I watched the game, I went to the game, I'm watching people, you know, watch the game, and, you know, on TV when they in between periods, everybody's, you know, screaming and with their Hawks jerseys while the announcers are recapping the last period, you know. But do you think at this point, I'm wondering, I'm not saying that this is, it's nothing bad, but I'm just wondering, right now, would you say the average Blackhawk fan is a Blackhawk fan or a hockey fan? I don't know if the average Blackhawk fan knows a lot about hockey in terms of, if I went up to somebody at the United Center and said, name me the first, name me the top three lines on the Washington Capitals.
Right.
I don't think they could tell the players.
Yeah, I think, so you're asking, are they just hockey fans or are they just, you know.
Yeah, are they hockey fans?
I think they know the game. You know, it's not just, you know, oh, Patrick Kane's cute or Jonathan Toews just scored. They know the game, but I think they're still more, like you said, Blackhawk backers. And then I think they're obviously, I mean, if you go to a game that the Capitals are playing, I think most of them do know, like, a couple of the main stars, like an Alex Ovechkin and people like that. But I think it's more just the Blackhawks. I'm a Blackhawk backer. Oh, they traded this guy, and this guy came up. They know a lot about their team.
It's going to be interesting to see now, as they continue, will those Blackhawk fans become hockey fans? And the reason I ask is because when I was a little kid, between hockey cards, and they used to have the game of the week. I mean, there was no such thing as ESPN back then.
Right, Channel 5 had the game of the week.
Yeah, NBC, with Peter Puck. They used to have this little cartoon of a puck to teach people hockey, how the way the game worked and everything. But between hockey cards and hockey magazines like Hockey Digest and things like that, I knew not just the Blackhawks, but I knew all the other teams.
Yeah, you knew their players, their numbers, what lines they were on, all those things.
And I'm just wondering now, it just seems that you can't, I mean, when you walk down the street anywhere, Chicago, downtown, suburbs, I mean, everybody has Blackhawk memorabilia. I mean, the Blackhawks have become a major sports entity, and it's great to see that as a longtime fan. But I'm wondering, as a sport, has hockey become, is it still the fourth sport? Because I'm just wondering, when I go to the games, I still get a sense that people are so caught up in the pageantry of the game, of the event, and they're so into the fact that the Hawks are a good team and they've got the banners with the Stanley Cup. And I have to say, I don't know whose idea this was, but whoever it is should get a bonus at the Blackhawks organization. When you watch the Blackhawks national anthem at the United Center, when Jim Cornelison, how do you say his name?
Cornelius.
I don't know. Jim C.
Yes, the guy sings real well.
Yeah. It's so great because, I mean, I think this is probably his touch where he goes, you know, when he goes, the flag was still there.
And he points with his arm, yeah.
But the cool thing is, which I don't know if a lot of people notice, if you're there when the song starts, and you're looking at the flag. You know, the flag is just draped and it's there. When he says the flag was still there and it's blowing, they have a fan that blows the flag at that point of the song.
See, it's part of showbiz, babe.
Yeah, and I'm like, that is genius.
Yeah.
And it's very subtle. But if you watch, the flag is for the majority of the song is all still. And then when he points, you know, and points to it, and the song talks about it's still there, and it's still waving. Then all of a sudden you see this air coming, and it starts to float. And I'm like, that is genius. And that's just one part of the experience. Like I said, they did an amazing job of turning this around, both on the ice and as far as a spectator goes. Because now I'm just hoping, because I love the hockey, the sport of hockey. I just hope that. That with time, because there are a lot of new fans, a lot of young fans, a lot of new people coming to the sport because of the Blackhawks. And I'll tell you, the thing is, too, the Blackhawks were so low on the totem pole here. Like the Cubs, they went for, what, 108 years?
Yeah, without the championship, right.
But they still drew people. The Blackhawks, yeah. To show how low they were, they almost had to win 3 Stanley Cups.
Yeah, just to get this going.
To get people, people had to see those rallies in Lincoln, you know, in Grant Park, and those parades to say, okay, this looks cool, and I want to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. Because they couldn't have just gotten better. Just getting better would not have 5 or 10 years of sellouts.
No,
they had to win.
Being able to say we're number one was a bigger deal.
And they had to win multiple times.
Yeah.
And that's what they've done. And like I said, I just wonder, like, I think you're right. I would venture to say, since because it's a newer fan base of so many people coming, but I do hope, because hockey is such a great sport, that I do hope that people become fans of the sport,
mm-hmm.
and not just fans of the team.
Right. Well, part of the problem too is, keep in mind, when we were growing up, there were a lot less teams. And there was a lot less movement of players from team to team as far as trades and free agency and things like that.
Yeah, that is true. That's a good point.
So it's harder now to say, oh, well, I know all the guys on the first 3 lines of the Flyers or the Capitals or the Penguins or whatever. But again, you know, people get into it so much. We've also got the age of information, so you can go online. If you really want to know everything about the Pittsburgh Penguins or the Detroit Red Wings or whomever, You can delve it out, and you can dig it out, and you can be an informed hockey fan.
I mean, right now, Boston Bruins, Phil Esposito center, Wayne Cashman and Kenny Hodge on the wings.
That's right.
Dallas Smith and Bobby Orr and Gary Cheevers in goal. Okay, that was 40 years ago.
Jerry Cheevers,
Jerry Cheevers. I still remember it.
Yeah,
you know, and so I just hope that hockey as a sport here in Chicago, fans become more cognizant of the entire sport and not just the team, because I mean, how about the fact that Las Vegas is going to have a hockey team,
and now they're going to get the football team with the Ravens.
Yeah.
It's going to be like, plus with the sports betting and everything else, it's just going to be a mecca for a lot of action.
I mean, the thing is, we are spoiled here, too, in Chicago, because, you know, believe me, folks, if you are a Hawks fan or a hockey fan, the thing is that you go to the United Center, you watch a game on TV. There are a lot of cities in the NHL that are not selling out every night, that there's maybe 5,000 people at. So hockey is still, sadly, As much as it's grown in its popularity, and the Blackhawks have played a big role in that, I think it's still the fourth sport behind basketball.
Right. Well,
and football
and
baseball.
In Chicago, I can't believe people are going to Bulls games.
Yeah, I know. That's really delusional.
Yeah, it's like you guys are so far away from anything good, and why you're paying attention to that right now, it's just an inferior product right now.
But still, here's the point. To your point, though, I'll tell you why. Because people love basketball.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's my point. I guarantee you, like, for instance, on a sport, say an all sports station, right?
Yeah.
You could have a 4-hour show talking about nothing but NBA basketball, and you'll get phone calls. People will know all about the teams. They'll know about the draft. You know, look at the NBA draft. It's an event in itself. My gosh, in Chicago, it was, a week's worth of Grant Park.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you had a radio show on a sports station in Chicago, could you say, okay, we're going to talk about 4 hours of hockey?
That would be tough.
I don't know if you could fill that. That's my point.
You'd be draining the well pretty quickly.
Right. But basketball and football and baseball, people know about not just their team, but they know about the college ranks, or they know about the minor leagues, and they know deep into these other teams and the pitchers or the quarterbacks or the centers and the forwards. And like I said, I hope that kind of knowledge base grows, because that's the only way it's really going to become a real, real major sport. It certainly is grown in the last 10 years or so. But it's still, sadly, I think, overall, you know, the fourth sport. But here in Chicago, I would say the Blackhawks and the Cubs are neck and neck.
Yeah.
And even though the Cubs just won the World Series, I think the Blackhawks are still right up there with the Cubs, which is an amazing thing. When the year before Bill Wirtz died, Rocky Wirtz's father, before Rocky Wirtz took over, there was a survey done by, I don't remember who did it, of not just hockey franchises.
But sports franchises.
Sports franchises of all kind, all the major sports. The Blackhawks were last.
Yeah.
The Blackhawks, and that was less than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And in the span of less than 10 years, they have gone from last, not just in hockey, but in all sports, to one of the premier sports franchises in the world.
Well,
one that everybody, whether you're a baseball team or a football team or a hockey team or a basketball team, you are modeling yourself on how the Blackhawks are run and how they are run as an organization and how they are marketed. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, and you had a great convergence there, because first William Wirtz dies, and while they're still throwing dirt on his grave, Rocky Wirtz is on the phone calling the local TV channel saying, I want to put home games on TV now. He had the young players. He had Taves and Kane starting to come, getting ready to come up. So there were a lot of things that came together with that. And then, of course, the hiring of John McDonough to run the Blackhawks, and Jay Blanc and all these guys. That's just, like you said, that's a great job with the marketing. All that convergence is what helped turn this around the way it did.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, Mick, I got to tell you, I had a great time just here chatting and BSing with you on the, I don't know if it is officially called this the radio, but it's sort of radio.
It's audio. Let's go with that.
But I appreciate you taking the time out from your schedule, and you are welcome here anytime.
Well, I got that special card, so I get
you
it.
Are.
I am like a, you know, those lifetime members to
yeah.
clubs and things. I'm golden.
No,
there,
there's no deal. So. You have the golden ticket. You are 00001. That is your memberships card. So, Mick Kaler, you can hear his work on a regular basis on WGN television in the morning, on the morning news. Mick, along with a friend of his, Al Flash, write parody songs about different things going on in the news and things like that. So if you listen or you watch WGN TV news, you will certainly hear Mick's work. And once again, thank you so much for taking time. And it's always fun to reminisce about Mick and Jim's Hucklebuck update.
Long time ago.
Yes, it was. Thanks a lot, Mick.
My pleasure, Pat. We'll talk to you.
And this has been episode 46, right? Yeah, 46 of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode posted on WGNplus.com. So please visit often and every Monday and go to my landing page and find all the other episodes. I'm Elton Jim. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This show is from the end of the web to your screen.